But your feeling is that these were kind of individual landowners who, for one reason or another, either thought their own land was threatened or...
Yeah. they would get together and have meetings occasionally, write letters, come to hearings. It was obviously a network of them. But many of them were just simply ill-tempered at the whole idea of having the Park Service up there and what they regarded as their territory.
Well, tell me about the Washington County government, and particularly there was a planning type of commission that Don Frush was head of.
They did an excellent job, I think, not just in terms of the canal, but in the general setting down a framework of environmental and land use policy for a county in which even zoning had been unpopular. Don and some others in the Maryland Wildlife Federation were among the people that we consulted a lot about various provisions of the legislation, problems, public relations, all sorts of things. They were very much pro-canal. One of the crucial meetings when the bill was redrafted was held in Don's basement. And he was in a key position because of what he was doing on the Planning Commission, as well as through the Wildlife Federation circles, and actually developed a very good basic plan for the whole county while he was in that job, which meshed in with the whole notion of protecting the river. I mean, that I suppose would be an example that you would cite, and to some extent that we did cite, time and time again, to support the notion that you start with grassroots efforts in a basin like this, because there the grassroots efforts have worked.
What were Frush's interests in all of this? Is it balancing a variety of interests?
He also grew up right near the river. Washington County native who has a very deep attachment to the land and to the kind of rural character of much of Washington County. This was, of course, in the era of the great boom in second homes, when there was a lot of apprehension about the impact of small subdivisions scattered around the county in cases where they'd be relying on septic tanks and would be cutting new roads through hillsides and so on. Washington County from the beginning was more ambivalent about this than, say, West Virginia, which welcomed them. And so Don's efforts to develop a land use plan for the county really came at a crucial time.
Was tell me about John P. Saylor, Pennsylvania congressman,
who, for reasons I don't know, got into a lot of park-type fights in the National Capital Region. He was from Western Pennsylvania, a big coal mining country, marvelous gruff guy, who got into a series of park issues around here, picked up early on the canal and was really the senior non-Maryland champion of it in the House.
Now, was he a Democrat?
No, he was a Republican. He was ranking Republican on Interior, House Interior, for some years, and was a very key ally to have.
Was he in on planning meetings, or was it just...
Well, he didn't get into the legislative drafting level of things. But no, he didn't really have any staff people, and we would be very careful to keep him informed at every step.
Someone named Malcolm King of the Isaac Walton League.
Was yet another person who was in on a lot of this and was in frequent contact. In terms of specifics, I'd have to look at the files.
Sure.
You develop any project like this that goes on so long, develops a circle of sort of regulars.
Well, let me run by another kind of interest, and you've alluded to them already, the Maryland state government.
Mm-hmm.
How was, at that, when you were first getting involved in this, Agnew, well, not first, but
mm-hmm.
Had become governor, and you had a meeting with Cynthia Rosenwald, who was his, I'm not sure exactly what she was for the governor.
I can't remember myself exactly what her title was.
Kind of his liaison.
Involved in some of these things, yeah.
Was he supportive, or?
Yeah, the key factor in Maryland was always basically the top career people in the natural resources field. The longtime secretary of DNR, or of what became DNR, was Jim Colder, who has been a basically friendly supporter of the project for a long time. In fact, he's now, he is still on the Canal Commission, even though he's no longer, he retired as Secretary of DNR. But there really were two kinds of things that we kept going back and forth with the state about. One was state intentions for specific pieces of property along the river, some of which are wildlife refuges, state parks, which operate under different rules from the federal parks. For instance, you can have hunting in some state park areas. Working out the fact that an expanded federal operation and the state operation could coexist took a while, but there wasn't a lot of trouble on that score. Mostly it was water-related questions that got sticky, and they got sticky partly because along with the whole park effort, of course, was the whole water supply question, water quality question that was moving along, and Maryland was very understandably possessive about the Potomac being Maryland's river and wanted to be absolutely sure that having an active federal ownership along the whole waterfront between Rock Creek and Cumberland did not mean that the feds were going to tell Maryland how to run the Potomac water quality and water supply. And that got into a number of very tedious discussions. And, as I say, some last-minute effort to put some legislative language in. And they wanted to be sure, as the many of the business people up and down the park wanted to be sure, that the Park Service would not use the park to block access for things like water lines and power lines. There had been a case in which a transmission line had gotten hung up, partly because the Park Service was using its permit authority to dictate some changes in the route. And this made all the state people nervous, as well as a lot of the local people. So we were constantly reaffirming that the issue along the canal would not be whether you could cross, but simply wonder what kinds of design rules. But it seemed that every time that the state personnel changed, we had to go through all that again.
Let me talk a little more about this water problem that arose at the end. There was this involved discussion over high and low water marks.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the state law was in the process of changing, but it was unclear as to where.
One of the difficulties with state law at that point was the wetlands disputes, which had just begun to develop. And it wasn't clear exactly what definition of, for instance, navigable applied, where the state lines of control reached, and whether any of the rules that were being hammered out in tidal areas applied also above the Little Falls. So this is one reason.
Where they weren't high and low.
Well, where it's not tidal,
yes.
Where it's a free-flowing river. So this is why you find in the Senate committee report a sentence that basically says that nothing in this bill is supposed to affect the situation, whatever it is, because no one was quite sure what it is. So, but it really took continuing statements by the federal people, including interior people, that they had no intention of getting into this. This was a land-related bill. And state people gradually being brought around, usually sort of one by one, to understand this.
You know, in fact, in the course of all this, it became apparent that if the state, from what I gather, really was adamant that they didn't want a bill without explicit language spelling out the state's interest. And
they kept asking for it. They never got it, but they kept asking for it.
And to do that would mean not only to have to write a different Senate bill, but then to go back to the House.
Exactly.
And which would have
mm-hmm.
killed the bill that
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Come October or so, you wanted the senator to send a letter to the state authorities, DNR and the governor and whoever,
mm-hmm.
Saying basically that it's too late and that they'd have to settle for the legislative history. That letter languished on his desk and never got sent.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, can you speculate why?
An awful lot of things languished on his desk for no particular reason from time to time, simply because there were so many other things on his desk that sometimes things that he wanted to make minor changes in, he would set aside until he had that moment when he could concentrate on it. And the moments had a way of not coming. So I don't know whether... in any case, it is a little hard to say that because something didn't get signed for a while, there was a serious substantive reason why not.
Yeah.
But in this case particularly, we did wind up doing it through legislative language. And
is it a case of just not wanting to be the bearer of bad news to the state?
Well, it may be that. It may also be sort of thinking that if you avoid deciding this, maybe something will work out. As it happened, of course, the state's now number of people involved with the park keep reminding the state that it's their river and they insisted on this, and therefore why don't you do something better about river safety instead of asking the Park Service to take over that whole responsibility. Done that several times.
What was Potomac Edison's role in all of this? There's some power line case.
That was the power line case, which did not involve the legislation, but
right.
involved the question of the federal role again. I don't recall that they were difficult particularly.
They weren't concerned that having this as a major a park mm-hmm. was going to affect their long-term interests.
Well, actually, they've been reasonably good neighbors. And I think once they understood that it was not going to be used to block transmission lines, much of their concern evaporated.
Now, Alan Bible was the
right.
the chair mm-hmm. of the, the Interior Committee?
Subcommittee.
All right.
As well, yeah.
What was his role?
Basically friendly. And the kind that, that sort of eventually, when he got around to it, would and he saw that all the bits and pieces had fallen into place, held the hearing. It was quite clear that his staff person, Bernie something, felt perfectly at ease working very closely with us on the legislative language, for instance, in the drafting of the committee report, partly because it was such a rush. So it really was a matter of, I think...
Does that mean you wrote the committee report?
Chunks of it, yes. Drafted it. And, well, I offered to help, and Bernie accepted it, and he changed some things and improved some things, and it got done. This was in the last week before Christmas. Mm-hmm. But Bible was generally very helpful.
There's some evidence that Bible was being intransigent, I thought, in the files.
Slow.
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 And on one particular occasion, late in the year, you thought the senator ought to corner Scoop Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the senator had done some favor for Jackson because you wrote that he had a large chip to cash in. And on the memo, the senator says, "I've taken care of this."
Mm-hmm.
What was the chip to cash in?
I believe it had something to do with the vote on some national security issue. I can't remember what it was.
I'm sure we can figure it out.
Yeah, you can probably figure it out, but I would say look at the Senate votes, at the hot Senate votes
yeah.
in that period, because you see, Jackson was friendly to the project and had very close ties with some of the longtime Canal Association people who were at the first wave of support for it, so that they could get to Jackson, as well as certainly Mac was on generally good terms with Jackson. And of course Jackson and Bible were quite close, as well as Jackson being in the a key role himself. So we tried everything.
Well, in 69, Jackson reintroduced the Potomac River Basin bill in mm-hmm. the Senate. Was that for him an important issue, or was it just...
I don't think it was too important, no. Yeah. No.
It was... Was it the fact simply that there was no longer a Maryland senator to...
That may have been something...
I don't know where
Tiding
stood on this issue.
I think you're about as far away from it as possible.
There's one other name that appears a lot in the files, and that's Spencer Smith.
Mm-hmm.
What was his role?
Was one of the Jackson-type environmentalists that I just mentioned, who had been involved in this for years, and along with other things. And, again, was working quite closely with us, was a very good source of information and ideas, and... worked with the interior committees on a number of projects, so he was always helpful about what their general approach was at a given time and what the chairman's attitude might be.
Let me ask you about some specific meetings, and you may not remember. If you don't, that's fine. In 1969, the Acapete Foundation had several meetings, one at Mount Vernon, and then there was another one in April, the Mount Vernon meeting, I think, in January. Do you remember those meetings at all?
Only dimly.
You suggest to the senator that he might ought to talk to Russell Train early on because of some advice he's getting from the interior people, the National River faction. Did he ever do that?
I'm not sure. Not sure on that one.
Let me ask you about another. There's the meeting with the May 1970 meeting with Hickel. After the meeting, you advised the senator that he ought to go to Senators Randolph and Byrd with sackcloth. What do you think that meant?
Without seeing the memo, I can't. I'm not sure. It may have been that there was a certain amount of questions of humility involved, but I'm not. I just can't tell without seeing the piece of paper.
It seemed to me that if Randolph and Byrd are, because of their constituency, opposed to the National River, that in many ways they ought to be amenable to the C&O Canal, or was it because they saw that as a threat? That, you know, this is the first initial step toward a larger plan.
Well, I don't know that some of their constituents certainly felt that way. I don't know that they did. That one I just am not sure of.
My impression in reading all this is that Matthias was, in terms of his interest in the environment at this point, he was much more influenced by historical interest, and I would say it's a kind of nostalgia or an appreciation for the Maryland that he knew and wanted to preserve, perhaps, as opposed to strictly environmental sorts of issues. Is that an accurate?
Well, it's accurate to a point. I think the Maryland he knew included a large amount of what came to be called environmental values, and so that there's not really a contradiction between those two statements. Certainly this was the countryside that he knew best. It was personal and specific in that sense. Nostalgic, only in the sense that change kept advancing over the mountain during those years. There are areas that are suburban now that in 1970 were still farmland. Middletown Valley is a key example. So that I don't know that it was all nostalgia, because not all of it had yet changed in the 70s. Or in the early 70s. But no, I do think that overall his interest in the Potomac and in the canal is a specific interest derived from his attachment there more than it is a kind of specific application of a general principle. He certainly doesn't get so fervent about parks elsewhere, much as he feels very strongly about parks as a general proposition.
You obviously had a strong personal stake in these issues and later went on to write about these types of things for the Post, and as you told me now, you're chairman of the commission that you helped to create.
Which is an interesting experience.
Yes.
Yes.
Do you remember times in the midst of all this that you and the senator or the congressman disagreed on approaches to?
I don't know that we disagreed substantively so much as it may have been partly a matter of his wanting to be more gentle in bringing along people in Western Maryland, for example. Or in some cases maybe a little more gentle in trying to push his colleagues than I wanted to be. But I don't remember us having any arguments over the content of the program, no. Tactics, yeah, to a certain extent.
Looking back on it, do you think the tactical approaches that he used were the right ones?
Well, as opposed to what? I mean,
could he have been more aggressive toward the Western Maryland, West Virginia sorts of people and gotten a bigger piece of the Potomac in federal hands?
It's hard to say. It's hard to speculate on just what might have, you know, might have been. Especially when it worked out.
When I asked you initially about the principles that guided the senators or the congressman's approach to this piece of legislation, you mentioned things like his preservation instinct, the human history of the canal, the gradual, less ham-handed approach, mm-hmm. and his general optimism. In reading the memos, I would have mentioned some other things, and maybe you could comment on those. And I don't think it's because, you know, local initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
Citizen participation.
Well, this is I think an aspect of that sort of history of this being a populated basin, as well as something that he feels very strongly about generally. The general principle we did, it was much more than the kind of nice political noises about how the local people should be involved, which is a song that's usually very handy to sing on a lot of these. But he really believed it, the Park Service came to believe it, and it has worked spectacularly well in a lot of cases along this park, because you do have a long history of people being there, and they know the area better than, you know, the planners do in some cases. And it's a small scale enough operation that the park is not insulated from any of the territory it goes through at all. And in general,